Part 11 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Scrutinies, Part 3.
All right, and with that we shall proceed in our discussions now. We have concluded 4 sermons on the last occasion, and so that leaves us now 3 more. So the narrative goes on. The following night, the dead appear once more, and in their increasingly insolent manner, they approach noisily, pushing, shoving, and scoffing, as they exclaim, "Teach us, fool, about the church and Holy Communion," as the text in this edition of the Red Book has it, but it is better translated as Holy Community. In fact, later on, the word community is mentioned again, so this initial introduction is a somewhat faulty translation. Philemon then begins to speak, and he begins with the first sentence of the 5th sermon. "The world of the gods is made manifest in spirituality and sexuality. The celestial ones appear in spirituality, the earthly in sexuality." Now there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. When speaking of the gods, we once again need to keep in mind that the beings or entities, archetypal forms here described as gods, are something very different from the concept of the monotheistic gods. Those of you who have some familiarity with Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, would find probably an analogy in the Buddhist deities, and certainly not anything resembling the Jehovic monotheistic image. In 1925, in a seminar dealing with these visions, Jung said, "Sexuality and spirituality are pairs of opposites that need each other." Now, this subject can lead to a controversial field, because certainly there are many linkages of one kind or another between religion or spirituality on the one hand and matters relating to sexuality on the other. One may take cognizance of the Hindu teachings and practices relating to Kundalini, but also to traditional mystery practices of the West, ancient mystery practices. It is well known that it is, for instance, as an indication of this, it is well known that it is canonically not permissible in Catholic Christendom to ordain a eunuch to the priesthood, an issue that caused the Church Father Origen back in the early days of Christendom much difficulty, because he was a eunuch and he had a very hard time getting ordained. Also, in Freemasonry, it is not, I hope I am not being clandestine by mentioning this, it is not permissible to confer Masonic initiation on an old man in his dotage. One wonders why. So it seems plausible that some sort of sexually related energy was considered an essential ingredient of the practice of religious spiritual mysteries. Even though he considers these two principles linked, Philemon also distinguishes them markedly, and here are some of his words from the sermon. "The sexuality of man is more earthly, that of the woman is more spiritual. The spirituality of man is more heavenly. It moves toward the greater. The spirituality of woman is more earthly. It moves toward the smaller." And then come some sentences containing, again, some rather dubious translation, such as, "Mendacious and devilish is the spirituality of man, And then it says, and it moves toward the smaller. In the German original translates as when it moves toward the smaller, which certainly makes more sense. And then it goes on, mendacious and devilish is the spirituality of woman, in the gender word, and this here when it should be when it moves toward the greater. Now, the inadequate translation here is quite serious and glaring. The only possible excuse for it might be that the translators were using, in addition to the version written down and published by Jung in his little book, and subsequently in the Red Book, other alternative German texts, which may be at times different from the one that Jung published. I would advise readers to avail themselves, if they are thus inclined, of my translation, which followed exactly the German text in Jung's small book. Now, once again, the context justifies the translation that differs from the translation in this Red Book. But the technicalities of translation aside, what is the sermon saying to us here? Jung seems to enumerate certain profound psychological characteristics of the male and the female psyche. One needs to keep in mind also that the word translated, and I'm sorry to come back to translation again, so I am both blessed and cursed with the fact that I know German. You know, if I didn't, then I could just gloss over all of this blissfully, as no doubt many people do. But so that the word translated as spirituality here, and it's the German word Geistigkeit, and that is at least idiomatically different from the contemporary meaning in the English language and the popular meaning of spirituality. Geist in German means spirit, but it also means mind. For instance, the German word for what in English we call the liberal arts is the Geisteswissenschaften, the spiritual sciences. Okay? So it's a much wider concept. So we may be justified in assuming that we are dealing here with a psychological meaning rather than with the metaphysical religious one of spiritual, that we would call spiritual. Now, of course, all such terms are used often in a very vague and a very imprecise and incorrect way by a lot of people. And so nowadays there is a great deal of talk and very little practice of spirituality. And, you know, people will often say, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And if you have then exchange a few more words with the person, then you see what what an example of mendacity that was. But in any event, thus we may be dealing here with a certain psychological meaning. So one might say that there are certain differences between the psychology of men and women. And that certainly is part of Jungian psychology. It has always been known as being a part of it. And masculine psychology might, in this view, have a tendency to move toward abstractions, while feminine psychology might tend toward the pragmatic and personal approach. On the other hand, masculine sexuality may be said to be intensely instinctual in orientation, while feminine sexuality may be more complex, strongly mingled with emotional elements. So such distinction may be viewed with suspicion in the contemporary feminist era, but it is difficult to deny such distinctions entirely or to deny them a measure of validity. So the sermon continues to expostulate upon the two principles, spirituality and sexuality, and admonishes people not to identify with either of them. The sermon calls these both powers that are not the property of any human, but that are collective powers that, instead of being possessed by humans, have a tendency to possess humans. And I think there we might refer to the sermons themselves. Let's just see where we are. Yeah. Spirituality and sexuality are not your qualities, says the sermon. Not things you possess and encompass. Rather, they possess and encompass you, since they are powerful daimons, manifestations of the gods, and hence reach beyond you, existing in themselves. So we are dealing with something sovereign and autonomous here. Instead, no man has a spirituality unto himself, or a sexuality unto himself. Instead, he stands under the law of spirituality and of sexuality. Therefore, no one escapes these daimons. You shall look upon them as daimons, and I use the word daimon because daimonion is, I think, the original Greek, and it certainly, you know, means a spirit, a spiritual power, not a demon, as in an infernal or evil entity in much modern usage. So, therefore, no one escapes these daimons. You shall look upon them as daimons and as a common task and a danger, a common burden that life has laid upon you. Thus, life too is for you a common task and danger, as are the gods, and first and foremost, the terrible Abraxas. So, the most likely interpretation of this is that these two powers of the collective unconscious, they are powers of the collective unconscious, and one must be on guard not to be overtaken by them, not to be possessed by them. It is easy to see in the case of sexuality, for we are all familiar with sexual obsessions, even to the point of dreadful crimes committed with perverted sexual motives. But what about spirituality? We need to recall that the Geistigkeit, spirituality mentioned here, is, as I just indicated, something somewhat different from what today colloquially we call spirituality. It is far better to think here of obsessions with ideas and concepts. An idea, a concept, an ideology, part of an ideology would definitely be considered part of Geistigkeit in German. So I think that that pertains here. And we may well remember that the greatest collective horrors visited upon humanity were the results of such obsessions. Attila, the Hun, possibly a distant relative of the Hungarians, you know. But we have changed a bit, you know. Attila, the Hun, saw himself as the scourge of God, chosen to punish peoples, as did Chaka, the mad Zulu king, in a later period of history. Hitler was possessed by the idea of the evil of the Jews, as Stalin, Mao, and the murderous Cambodian Marxist Pol Pot were possessed by the need to eliminate all real and imagined and even potential opponents to their regime. Thus, one needs to distance oneself from collective daimons. The temptation to become identified with ideas, indeed with systematized ideas, and to then live out all kinds of strange and unfortunate impulses under the auspices of these ideas is very, very great. And, of course, the self-serving way of dealing with this of various people is, oh, I am an idealist. Watch out. You know? There is a kind of idealism that can turn you into a veritable devil. People who are, you know, committing reprehensible acts because of selfish human motives, whatever they may be, greed, sex, heaven knows what else, you can do business with them because they are still human. But people who become possessed by ideas are very, very dangerous. There is no way of doing business with them. Very, very difficult situations arise in that fashion. So one needs to distance oneself from such collective daimons. The next subject addressed by Philemon in the fifth sermon is community. Not communion as indicated at the beginning by a somewhat inexact translation. Now here there are two opposites which are mentioned. And they are community and what once again in a somewhat labored fashion is called in the English text singleness, which might be more accurately translated as solitude. In any event, community and so-called singleness. Community is stated to be indispensable because of the weakness of humans. Singleness or solitude appears here as a euphemism for individualism, community for the collective. Interestingly, the sermon states that community exists because of man's weakness with regard to the gods and daimons and their invincible law. What may be meant by this? The gods and daimons, at least in my estimation, are archetypes, including violence, power, rapacious greed, and others. So community counteracts these forces and protects the powerless. But there is an interesting caveat in the sermon, which runs as follows. Insofar as the gods impose community upon you, it is necessary to the extent that this is imposed upon you by the gods. More is bad. So the last three words, I think, are significant. Collective social structures, as no doubt we are aware, very frequently become self-serving. They become oppressive, destructive, destructive of individuality and of freedom. Thus one needs to allocate only so much power to what here is called community, namely the state, government, and so forth, but no more. And of course that's difficult to do because governments attract power to themselves sort of in the manner in which a magnet attracts iron shavings. It's the nature of the beast. So it is up to the individual to say, so far and stop. We are not going to give more power to the community, to the collective, to the state. So the sermon concludes with the metaphoric statement, community gives us warmth, singleness gives us light. At the end of the sermon, the dead look upon Philemon with expectation, as if they expected more. Thus, for the first time, Philemon does not disappear, but continues with the next sermon without disappearing or departing. You may recall that in all the sermons when he spoke at the end and then usually discoursed for a while with Jung and gave him some explanations, then he disappeared. In this case, he does not. So the next, namely the fifth and the seventh sermon, both of these are much briefer than any of the preceding ones. The sermons sort of decrease in length toward the end. The sixth sermon concerns a further set of characteristics of the two world spirits, somewhat like the ancient Greek world spirits of Eros and Logos. Eros would be, of course, the sexuality. He calls sexuality here. Logos would be spirituality, again, in the sense of mind. So here, as in the fifth sermon, they are still called sexuality and spirituality. So this graphic symbolism, which we find in the sixth sermon, no longer merely a verbal description and allusion, but an imagery, which we will come to right away. This graphic symbolism of imagery brings these powers into greater and more dramatic focus than the largely conceptual account presented in the fifth sermon. The fifth sermon begins thus: the daimon of sexuality approaches our soul as a serpent. She is half a human soul and is called sought desire. The daimon of spirituality descends into our soul as the white bird. He is half human soul and is called sought desire. Now, the sermon takes advantage of the feature of the German language that assigns gender to nouns, which is, of course, something that we don't have in English. And thus, snake, Schlange, is a feminine noun, die Schlange, while the white bird is a masculine noun, der weiße Vogel. And thus, the daimon of sexuality is introduced as a feminine power and has the form of a snake. If we wanted to be very fancy and Greek here, we would say it's ophiomorphic. How would you like that, you know? So it's shaped, you know, like a snake. Contrary to Freudian phallic serpentine symbolism, which needs no further explanation, I think. Those who need such explanations may profitably find it elsewhere. they don't need to find it here. You know. And the bird, in terms, is introduced as masculine. Now, the sexuality serpent is revealed as being largely of a ctonic nature, namely related to the earth, coming out of the earth, and related to what is in the depths of the earth, underneath the earth. The white bird is definitely an airy celestial being, a messenger of, as Jung says it, of the Mater Celestis, the heavenly mother. Both beings are necessary and potentially helpful to the human. So we need to keep that in mind. After the conclusion of the sixth sermon, prompted by the contemptuous remarks of the dead — they are really problematic beings, shall we say — Philemon delivers a discourse to the dead, which the dead interrupt repeatedly. When Philemon had finished, the dead looked on with contempt and said, "Hey, I carried that over. I saved it from the fire. That is the son of the fire flower. You saw that in me. I myself am of the eternal fire of light." That's an interesting way in which Philemon speaks of himself. "But I am the one who saved it for you, the black and golden seed and its blue starlight. You eternal being, what is length and brevity? What is the moment and eternal duration? You being are eternal in each moment. What is time? Time is the fire that flares up, consumes, and dies down. I saved being from time, redeeming it from the fires of time and the darkness of time, from gods and devils. But I said to him, 'Illustrious one, When will you give me the dark and golden treasure and this blue starlight? Because he speaks of this treasure that he brought over, he brought out of the process. Philemon replied, when you have surrendered everything that wants to burn in the holy flame. So there are definitely clear indications here, not only of the nature of the process, but of other profound mysteries as well. The dead are once again described as human beings who believed in a sort of transformation and development of man. And that was sort of strange to me when I read that. Well, isn't that what you are talking about? But I think that that is something else. We are dealing here probably with the, once again, with the Enlightenment era teaching of human perfectibility, which comes to be interpreted in rationalistic terms as evolution with a biological basis. The dead abandoned belief in God or gods. They did not know the true spiritual and transcendental role of the human being as a gate toward transcendental being. So Philemon's final sentence in this discourse, I saved being from time, redeeming it from the fires of time and the darkness of time, from gods and devils. So these words indicate once again that Philemon is much more than a fantasy figure or a mask for Jung's higher self as such, but rather an avataric figure, a salvific hierophant, telling Jung that he would receive the dark and golden treasure only when he has surrendered everything that wants to burn to the holy flame, indicates that one must sacrifice many elements of one's psyche that need to be burned by the holy flame. It's also, it's a very interesting twist, and I'll conclude on that note, that these elements that act as obstacles within our nature, to the greater, to the birth of the divine child within us, that they themselves, what they really want to be burned up. To us it appears as they are holding us back. They are standing here as obstacles, as sentinels, as, you know, the stone that needs to be rolled away. As Blavatsky said at one time, he who has the strength to roll back the stone of matter from his own inner sanctuary, he has the risen Christ in him. Jung could have very easily written that. But you see, the stone, apparently, the stone wants to be rolled away. The stone is part of the process also. The stone has its own consciousness, and it doesn't want to really act as an obstacle anymore. And if we let it, then it will move into the flame and burn up. The obstacles will burn up, and we will stand freely capable of confronting the greater reality, the greater glory, which to experience has been our calling and our destiny all along. And these, I think, are amazing and wonderful insights which need to be internalized and need to become part of our experience. And if indeed they will, then something very, very marvelous and very, very gloriously promising has come to us in this time and in this year. And I do feel very, very strongly that that indeed is the case. So I thank you very much.
Copyright MS by DC Recordings, catalog number 200511. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.